All his life, Joe Cicero had worked with black Africans, the nationalist leaders of the forces of liberation and the socialist struggle. He had known them all, Jomo Kenyatta and Kenneth Kaunda, Kwame Nkrumah and Julius Nyerere. Some of them he had come to know intimately, men like Moses Gama, who had been sent to a martyr's death, and Nelson Mandela, who was still languishing in the prison of white racism. Cicero placed Raleigh Tobacco in the forefront of that illustrious company. In fact, Raleigh had been Moses Gama's nephew, and Raleigh had been present the night the South African police murdered his uncle. He seemed to have inherited Moses Gama's tremendous personality and force of character, and he had stepped squarely into the wide gap left by Gama. He was 30 years old, but already he was deputy director of Umkhonto weSizwe, the spear of the nation, the military wing of the South African National Congress, and Joe Cicero knew that he had proved himself time and again in the field and in the councils of the ANC. He had the talent, the guts, and the verve to rise as high as any other man in Africa. Joe Cicero preferred him to the white Spanish aristocrat, but he recognized that despite their difference in color and lineage, they were men cast in the same mold, hard and dangerous men, well-versed in death and violence, adepts in the subtle shifting world of political power and intrigue. These were the men to whom Joe Cicero must hand over the reins, and he resented them and hated them for it. The woman, he said heavily, could be of extraordinary value, if she is controlled and developed to her full potential. But I will let the Marquez explain that to you. It is his case, and he has studied the subject fully. Abruptly, Ramon Machado's smile thinned, and his eyes turned flat and hostile. "I would prefer the comrade director not to use that title," he said coldly, "even in jest." Joe Cicero had learned that it was probably the only way he could penetrate the Spaniard's slick armour plating. "I beg your pardon, comrade," Joe inclined his head in mock contrition, "but please do not let my little lapse interrupt your recitation." Ramon Machado opened the loose-leaf binder that lay on the table in front of him, but he did not even glance at it. He knew every word it contained by heart. "We have assigned the woman the case name Red Rose, and we have had our psychiatrists develop a detailed profile of her. The evaluation is that she is highly susceptible to skillful recruitment. She is uniquely placed to become an extremely valuable field operative." Raleigh Tobacco leaned forward attentively. Ramon noted that he did not interject question or comment at this stage, and he approved of that restraint. They had not yet worked together extensively. This was only their third meeting, and both of them were still evaluating each other. "Red Rose can be placed in an emotional dilemma. On her father's side, she is a member of the white ruling class in South Africa. Her father is just finishing a term as his country's ambassador to Britain, and he returns now to take up an appointment as the chairman of the national armaments industry. He has enormous holdings in mining, land and finance. After the Oppenheimers and their Anglo-American company, the family is probably the most wealthy and influential in southern Africa. In addition, the father has conduits to the very highest levels of the ruling racist regime. The most important, however, is the fact that the father dotes on Red Rose. She is able to obtain from him, with very little effort, anything she sets her heart upon. This would include an entree to any level of government and any information of whatever classification, even that relating to his new appointment on the Armaments Corporation." Raleigh Tobacco nodded. He knew the Courtney family, and could find no fault with this assessment. "I have met Red Rose's mother, but she is on the other side of the political fence," he murmured. And Ramon nodded. "Precisely. Shaza Courtney has been divorced from his wife Tara for 7 years. She was an accomplice of your uncle, Moses Gama, in his bomb attack on the white racist parliament, for which he was imprisoned and subsequently murdered. She was also Gama's mistress and bore his bastard son. Tara Courtney fled from South Africa with Gama's child after the failure of the bomb plot. She lives now in London, where she is very active in the anti-apartheid movement. She is also a member of the ANC, but she is not considered sufficiently competent or emotionally stable for any but junior rank and routine assignments. At present she operates a safe house for ANC personnel here in London, and occasionally undertakes courier work or assists in the organisation of rallies and demonstrations. Her real potential value lies in her influence over Red Rose. Yes, Raleigh agreed impatiently. I know all about this, especially about her relationship to my uncle. But does she in fact have any influence over her daughter? It appears that Red Rose's sympathies lie heavily on her father's side. Again Ramon nodded. At present, this certainly is the case. But apart from her mother, there is another member of the family who holds radical views. Her brother Michael, who has a much greater influence on her. And there are other ways of turning her. What are those? Tabaka asked. One of them is the honey trap, Joe Cicero said. The Marquise, Comrade Machado has made the initial contact to that end. The honey trap is one of his many specialities. You will keep me informed of progress, Raleigh made a statement, and neither of them replied immediately. Although Raleigh Tabaka was an executive of the ANC and a member of the Communist Party, he was not, unlike the other two, an officer of the Russian KGB. Joe Cicero was, on the other hand, a KGB officer first and foremost, although his promotion from colonel to colonel general had been confirmed only a month previously, at the same time that the Moscow clinic had diagnosed carcinoma of both his lungs. Joe Cicero suspected that the promotion had been given to him merely to allow him to retire at the higher pension after a lifetime of loyal service to the department. Nevertheless, he was an officer of the ANC only after his loyalty to Mother Russia. His lines of allegiance were not diluted, and the ANC would receive only what information it was necessary for them to have. Ramon Machado's lines of allegiance were also clear-cut. He had been born in Spain, and his title of nobility was Spanish, but his mother had been a Cuban woman, slow-eyed and raven-haired. She had met Ramon's father when she was a young housekeeper on the Machado estates near Havana in Cuba. After the marriage, the Marquez had taken his beautiful commoner back to Spain. During the Spanish Civil War, the Marquez had opposed General Francisco Franco's nationalists. Despite his noble background and inherited wealth, Ramon's father had been an enlightened and liberal man. He joined the Republican army and commanded a battalion at the siege of Madrid, where he was severely wounded. After the war, the Machado family found oppression and discrimination under the Franco regime intolerable. The Marquesa prevailed on her husband to take her and her young son back to her native island in the Caribbean. Although they had been stripped of most of their Spanish property and possessions, the family still owned the Cuban estates. However, the Machado family found that life under the dictatorship of Batista was no great improvement on that under Francisco Franco. Ramon's mother was an aunt of the young left-wing student firebrand Fidel Castro and one of his avid admirers. She became active in the campaign of agitation and intrigue against the Batista regime, and young Ramon gleaned his own first political convictions from her and from her celebrated nephew. After Fidel Castro was imprisoned for leading the gallant but abortive attack on the Santiago barracks on the 26th of July 1953, both Ramon's father and mother were arrested along with the rebels. Ramon's mother died under interrogation in a police cell in Havana, and his father died in the same prison only a few weeks later of ill treatment and a broken heart. Once again the family estates were confiscated, and Ramon's only inheritance was the derelict title of Marquez, void of all property or fortune. At the time he was 14 years old. The Castro family took him in and cared for him. When Fidel Castro was released from prison under amnesty, Ramon went with him to Mexico, and at 16 years of age was one of the first recruits to the Cuban Army of Liberation in exile. It was in Mexico that he first learned how to exploit his extraordinary good looks and to develop his natural winning ways with women. By the age of 17, his companions had nicknamed him El Zorro Dorado, the Golden Fox, and his reputation as an irresistible lover was established. Up to the time of his father's arrest and death in Batista's prison, Ramon had been given the benefit of the finest education available to the only son of a wealthy aristocratic family. He had attended an exclusive preparatory school in England and spent 2 years at Harrow, so he spoke English like a native, as well as his own Spanish. During his school days he had demonstrated superior academic ability and had become proficient in the manners and pastimes of a young gentleman. He had a good seat on a horse, learnt to keep a straight bat, and cast a salmon fly. He was also a phenomenal shot at Spanish red-legged partridge or Mexican white-winged dove. He could shoot and ride and dance and sing, and he was beautiful. And when he returned to Cuba with Fidel Castro and the 82 heroes on the 2nd of December 1956, he proved his valour in the fighting which left most of the valiant band dead on the beaches. He was with the survivors that escaped with Castro into the mountains. During the years of the guerrilla warfare that followed, El Zorro was sent down into the towns and villages to practice his arts on scores of women, young and not so young, beautiful and plain. In Ramon's arms they became enthusiastic daughters of the revolution. With every conquest he became more skilled and confident, until his band of female recruits contributed significantly to the eventual triumph of the revolution and the overthrow of the Batista regime. By this time, Castro was fully aware of the potential value of his young relative and protégé, and once in power he rewarded him by sending him to further his education on the American mainland. While he studied political history and social anthropology at the University of Florida, Ramon used his amatory skills to infiltrate the band of Cuban exiles, who, with the collusion of the American CIA, were planning the counter-revolution and the invasion of the island. It was largely Ramon's intelligence that pinpointed the time and place of the Bay of Pigs landing, and resulted in the annihilation of the traitors. By this time, his extraordinary gifts had been recognized not only by his own countrymen, but also by their allies. When he graduated cum laude from the University of Florida and returned to Havana, the head of the KGB in Cuba prevailed upon Castro and the director of the DGA to send Ramon to Moscow for further training. While in Russia, Ramon exceeded the estimates that the KGB had made of his capabilities and his potential value. He was one of those remarkable creatures who could pass easily in any stratum of society, from the crude guerrilla camps of the jungle to the drawing rooms and private clubs of the most sophisticated capitals of the world. With the knowledge and blessing of Fidel Castro, he was recruited into the KGB. Given his connections, it was only natural that he should be appointed director of the Joint Committee coordinating Russian and Cuban interests in Africa. In this job, Ramon made a special study of the African socialist liberation movements, and he was responsible for selecting those organizations that were to receive full Russian and Cuban backing. He initiated the policy under which Cuba came to act as a surrogate for Mother Russia in southern Africa, and he was soon responsible for the supply of arms and the training of African resistance groups. And it was in that capacity he became a member of the ANC. In a very short time, he had visited all the African countries under his jurisdiction, using his Spanish passport and his title, posing as a capitalist investor and merchant banker with credentials supplied by the Fourth Directorate. He was accepted without reservation by the white colonial administrations, and was received cordially and entertained by everyone from the governors of Portuguese Angola and Mozambique to the British Governor-General of Rhodesia. He even dined with that notorious architect of apartheid, the South African leader, Hendrik Verwoerd. When it became necessary to appoint a new station head for the African division to replace the ailing General Cicero, Ramon's qualifications and experience made him the natural choice. So, as he sat now in the back room of the Russian consulate in Bayswater Road, with the man he was about to replace and this black African guerrilla leader, his loyalties were as clear-cut as those of his superior. When Raleigh Tabaka said, "You will keep me informed of progress," he was being naive. He would be informed only on a need-to-know basis. In Ramon's view and that of his government, the installation of this man and the organization which he represented as the ruling elite in South Africa was merely a single step along the road to the eventual goal of universal socialism throughout the length and breadth of the African continent. "Naturally, you will be kept right up to date with this, as with all other matters of joint interest," Ramon assured him, in a tone of such total sincerity that the black man settled more comfortably in his chair and returned Ramon's smile. Very few persons, male or female, were immune to his charms. It gave Ramon a solid sense of satisfaction to see the magic work on even such a tough and uncompromising subject as this one.